Cheek pockets.
Pockets.
We're here today for the first hour with the three of us: Tim Simmons, Aaron Lehman, Emma McCormick Goodhart. And later we're going to be joined by Ona Lindquist, and we will introduce her shortly. That's just at noon. You just heard Herbie Hancock's Watermelon Man, which is obviously very familiar to a lot of people's ears. But at the start there is actually a hocket between a whistle and a voice. We're going to explore many different kinds of hockets today, come through our own definitions, and see where we go.
Yeah, so starting with the most conservative musical definition of hocket, because it originates in, you know, as a form in music. In music, hocket is the rhythmic linear technique using the alternation of notes, pitches, or chords. In medieval practices of hocket, a single melody is shared between two or occasionally more voices, such that alternately one voice sounds while the other rests. And it comes from French hocket. I have no idea.
Okay.
Okay. I don't speak French. and that means interruption, hiccup, or shock.
The form is of extreme antiquity. Ars antiqua, also known as ars veterum or ars vetus, is a term used by modern scholars to refer to the medieval music of Europe during the High Middle Ages between approximately 1170 and 1310. In European music, hocket was used primarily in vocal music of the 13th and early 14th centuries. It was a predominant characteristic of music of the Notre Dame school during the Ars Antigua, in which it was found in sacred vocal music. In the 14th century, the device was most often found in secular vocal music. Guillaume de Machaut's Hoquetus David, which is this, represents one of the extant hockets of the Ars Nova. In one of the few modern studies on the genre in the first part of the 20th century, musicologist Marius Schneider wrote that the hocket was of extreme antiquity, in that the hocket was among the most elemental or earliest evolutionary forms of polyphony, bringing together two or more parts. Two parts in alternation, the truncation of a melodic line into fragments. It was not greatly different than the motet. Theorists of the 13th century mention hoquetus not only as a technique to be applied within the course of a motet, but also as an independent musical form. I quote Veit Eilmann. Resonance calls into question the notion that the nature of things resides in their essence, and that this essence can be exhausted by a sign, a discourse, a logos. An account of something such as resonance must therefore situate itself in a kind of echo chamber, together with other things, signs, discourses, institutions, and practices.
Now for our first exercise of the day. It's a very simple one, using one of my favorite moments in Gertrude Stein's Food, a chapter from her longer poem, Tender Buttons. So I'm going to read a bit of this entry, if we can call it an entry, called Orange Inn, which is following actually already three different entries of Orange. Orange, 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 Orange Inn. And then we're going to use the latter part of it to gear up an exercise, which will be mostly just using our voice. And we can find a way that our listeners can join in. Orange Inn. Golak, Golak used to her. Cocoa and clear soup and oranges and oatmeal. Whist bottom, whist clothes, woodling. Cocoa and clear soup and oranges and oatmeal. Pain soup, suppose it is question, suppose it is butter, real is only, only excreate, a nuisance. Now comes the Hockett part, or depending on how you look at Gertrude Stein's writing, you could think of it as internally a Hockett, but we're going to make a Hockett of it no matter. So there are, what did we decide, three or four parts to this. There are three of us, and each of us are going to take a term in the coming repetition of terms. You'll pretty quickly hear what's going on with our voices. It'll be hard to track, and then we'll come back around. Yeah, maybe we'll leave an opening for the muted voice on the other end of the line.
So there are, let's see, four words, and I'll take it's
you'll take A.
A, no, since, when. So I'll take A.
No, okay. I'll take no.
You're taking no. I'll take since.
And okay, I'll do when also.
Okay.
A one, a two, a three, a four.
A.
No.
A.
Since.
No.
All right,
we already made up. Let's start again.
A.
No.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
When. A.
No.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since. All right, let's do it. Let's. That was good.
So there's a lot of turn taking involved.
Yeah. let's start again. I mean, maybe hopefully you can still get a sense of the punctuation here. But let's start again. Should we drop out the?
Let's drop the when.
The when? That's too rare to drop out. Let's drop something out more common, no? Or you want to start off with that? Let's start off with dropping off the when, like Aaron says.
Yeah, if you're listening, you can... Well, I mean, it's easy for us. We have this written out, so...
We're going to make a pause, then. We'll just make a pause, and that's when the when comes in. Right?
We'll ghost the when.
Yeah. So, otherwise, same things?
Okay. One, two... Three. A.
No.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since. Since.
A.
No.
Since. Since.
A.
No.
Since. Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since. Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since.
A.
No.
Since. Beautiful. Mm. Should we switch one more out? So we take back the when and get rid of or give a different word to our listener. Maybe no. Is that too much?
Should we redact no?
Redact no or give it to our listener. Yeah.
Let's gift it.
Okay, let's gift it. I'm playing with my microphone too much. Hold on. So we are gifting no.
A. Since when?
Okay.
Right. So Aaron, you're A.
Correct.
Tim is since. You are
when.
When. And you, our listener, are no at the gaps, if you can find out what those gaps are.
If you can follow.
But I think by the time, I mean, this is, we're going to actually get into this. By the time that you realize that it's a gap, it might be too late for you to say it.
That's what I'm thinking, but.
Let's do it. Let's try it. It's going to be hard. So.
A. A.
Since.
A.
Since.
When.
A.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
Since.
A.
Since.
When.
Since.
A.
Since.
A. A.
Since.
A.
Since.
A.
Since.
A.
Since.
It's hard.
It's hard. Hope you could follow in there.
I mean, it's hard to do with all the words.
I think we're going to come back at different points to that weird lag of almost an, I mean, knowing where your place is, but also not knowing necessarily, even that your voice has started by the time that it's stopped. In that sense, this sort of interlocking hiccup, and almost a hiccup in your mind, in your memory. Should we keep going, or you want to do another one? We have some other exercises we're going to get to.
If we don't stop, we'll just keep with Stein for the rest of the hour.
That's true. So we are, we'll come back to some of these things that are emerging out of that exercise. Here's another example of Hockett, also from the time of Ars Antigua. Twist, curl of trust, doing one's best to give way to another breath, and the other finding a place to accelerate. No harmony, but so low, so unowned, that its tongue toils caked of moisture with loose earth. A kind of cloved tongue, hellish life of coordination, that speaks only in abbreviations. I ain't willow pink like a dog's lipstick. When you hear my voice furrow at the start of yours, anticipating, waiting. Belief, hold on, hold on, hold. It stinks, smells of rotten rose leaves. That voice in the knowing middle, tang. Not knowing who stopped thinking and who started talking. Burp rising. Sound of all the LKs, elk, walk, talk, milk, cock, sock, silk, rilk, wet and sharp, a slide and a stop. Tang. At the moment of a pass, that little overlap of one voice starting and another ending, caught for a second, like the pulling of interlaced fingers, snagging on knuckles. Or a twist at the hips, under some loss of coordinates, but linear direction, together. Or is it just a bit of memory, a lag in listening, something that we compress between a note just heard and now hearing, a twist and little sintering burn that makes two voices one in memory loss?
So as with Monk, what did we hear? A kind of sonic chandlery, of knot making, of stitching. Our last episode focused on canon, which is different than Hockett. Canon happens in succession. Hockett,
it has overlapping,
turns around, turns back on itself.
Yeah.
Creates loops.
The canon has overlapping voice. Whereas, yeah, the Hockett is more about turn taking.
Or that maybe the overlapping that happens in Hockett is something that is a lag or is in some ways unintentional. Is there and needs to be there, but is something that's, you know, it's two things trying to coordinate around each other.
Mm. It sort of happens in the interchangeability of...
Yeah, it creates a moment...
Parts.
Sorry, talking about turn taking. Well, yeah, in Hockett, it creates a moment of tension. I think that's something that seems to interest you, Tim. You know, like, because so much of the end effect is in the creation of a whole voice through participating in many different and staggered parts, when they do overlap, it creates a strange sort of jarring...
A choral voice.
...moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But I don't know if I would call it choral.
I mean, choral as one. A choral unity.
But an interesting difference that you brought up at the beginning of comparing it to canon, because in canon having this maybe cyclical, maybe it has like more of a kind of history of thinking about what the chorus is and how the chorus maybe repeats or reflects something that has already been said collectively, where the Hockett is like there is no voice. There is no single voice, and the single voice can only exist as in the real, as a schizophrenic one, or as one that's sort of divided, fragmented. But that's the real thing. It's not like that's a separated voice.
Yeah, right? It becomes a very beautiful whole through this sort of dutiful playing of a fragmented part.
And at the same time, I mean, as we are with microphones, or as we are, or as Meredith Monk is in this last piece, from Facing North that we just played, there's also, like, I mean, I think of it as this cloved tongue, like this sort of like hellish kind of trying to coordinate two things that happens in the snapping sound that comes from the overlap, this like incredibly, as we'll get to in a moment, this incredibly strange moment of the exchange zone, as it would be called in like a 4x100 relay race, where the exchange zone, where you actually pass a baton from one person to the other, and that like teeny little lag makes a very different sound than you get from either of the two voices alone. If you can even say that there are any voices that are alone.
Right. It often creates a fabric that can be almost unpierceable. It's unclear whose voice is which. And
yeah. I want to play one thing that we hadn't planned, which is sort of oddly just on the Wikipedia of Hockett. So it's easy to come back to if you ever want to look at it. And I think it must be synthesized. But... it gives a very clear picture of this kind of snap or this twist sound that you get where in a canon you would get those harmonic overlaps, or in a fugue, this very, you know, strict interplay that comes from counterpoint of notes. Here, what you're getting is something else, and I don't think any of us have the musical knowledge to be able to say what exactly that is, and it's part of why we're here. So I think that has, you know, I find that little thing very quirky. That's also from Seculum, which we played before, but maybe a very synthesized version of it. But you kind of get the feeling of even like on that delay that you get on a keyboard, where like you press down the note and then the sound starts to emerge. That lag, maybe in the same way that like when we were doing the first exercise, that lag where you're like, is it my spot to say no?
The trill of an in-breath.
Yeah, exactly. Well, should we keep moving on?
Yes.
Okay.
So, like with Hawkett, so much social form comes from sort of these taking of cues and knowing when your turn is and what to say. And in autism, the ability to recognize those cues are often not there, which makes for chaotic and sometimes detached social presence. And this is a sort of self-meditative script that autistic children can use to facilitate their participating in turn-taking. But being as you know, seeing as they cannot process these cues in the sort of what's called like a typical way, they have to use these sort of internal scripts, and this is one. Children play with their friends. I will be playing with my friends today. We will be playing a game together or playing with toys. One of my friends may want the toy I am playing with. This is okay, and I can give them a turn to play with my toy. While I'm waiting for them to give my toy back, I can choose another toy to play with. Sharing my toys and taking turns with my toys will make my friends happy, and they will want to play with me again. This is another one. I will be playing a game with my friends today. During this game, we will have to take turns and wait while others are having their turns. Taking a turn means that I can play, then my friends will have a chance to play. While I am waiting for my turn, I can draw a picture, look at my favorite character, count to 20 in my head, or watch my friends play out their next turn. When it is my turn, I will take my turn and then wait again while the next players take their turns. This will help the game to be fun, and everyone will enjoy playing the game while I wait and take a turn. So, there is this sort of... It seems like a lot of the therapy involved with autism is at least for this part, about... I don't want to say enforcing, but teaching somebody how to follow the sort of social Hawkett that, you know, if you can think of it that way, this form of turn-taking that creates a harmonious whole.
But beyond it being meditative, don't you think that there's some kind of, at least from what I heard in that script, that there's some kind of looking for something to occupy oneself when one is being, I mean, if we're comparing it to Hawkett, that like the voice that is mm-hmm. in recess, the voice that's giving space for another voice, is actually needing to occupy itself
Definitely.
In some other way.
It's
still
like,
active.
Yeah, it's like in when you're performing music, you know, you can, you know, you tap your foot to keep time. It's like it's almost like a timekeeping mechanism.
It's as if you need to do something physically to fulfill the moment when you're not doing something vocally.
Yeah.
I mean, this is in drawing an analogy from the script. It makes me think of that. It makes me think of like a time that the first time that I did discover Hockett's, which was in a Meredith Monk workshop, and I was horrible at these things. But when we were all paired up and we were singing a Hockett together, we were using the song "Now I Walk in Beauty."
How many of you were participating in this?
Total, it was a workshop of, I think, probably 13 or 14. It changed each day. But we were all facing each other. It was like you were in pairs to sing a Hockett. And it sort of felt like you had to make some gesture between the two of you when you're facing each other to when it wasn't your turn. It wasn't as much as like pointing at someone across from you and in order to cue them, as much as like you had to, it was as if you had to pass a ball back and forth,
right,
at the same time you were passing your voice back
and forth. To
be
a receptor of breath.
Right. But at the same time you had to be, it's as if you passed in order to do something physically when you were not doing something physically with your diaphragm in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, what this all, how it interests me is like, I don't know, even beyond music, musical form, that language and social form have less to do with content as much as the timing of gestures and turn-taking in that sense. And another really interesting social form, which this ritual that we've played in the past, is the ritual of mochitsuki, which is the making of mochi dough, where two people with hammer and fists alternate striking the mochi dough to work it. And they sing a song or chant with alternating exhalations to time their strikes. But here, unlike in the musical Hockett, the cost of interruption is a little greater than just a conversational overlap or a misplaying of the music. Someone's hands are going to get hit by a hammer.
We encourage you to find this as a video.
So that was two guys hitting mochi with a hammer really, really fast. And they sing their songs because one guy has a giant oversized hammer and one guy is hitting the dough with his hands. So if they don't sing the song right, he's going to get some broken fingers.
Crows have become highly skilled at making a living in these new urban environments. In this Japanese city, they have devised a way of eating a food that normally they can't manage. Dropping a nut from a great height onto a hard road does sometimes crack it. But some nuts are particularly tough. So the crows have devised a better way. Drop it among the traffic. The problem now is collecting the bits without getting run over. So some birds have refined their technique. They station themselves beside pedestrian crossings. wait for the lights to stop the traffic. Then collect your cracked nut in safety.
What is your full name? What is your complete home address? What is your date of birth? What is your place of birth? What is your spouse's complete name? What is your spouse's date of birth? What is your spouse's place of birth? How long have you lived at your current address? How many times have you been married? What are the names of your ex-spouses? What is the name of your employer? What is the name of your employer? How do you get to work? How does your spouse get to work? What is your job title? Spouse's salary? Your salary? What is your spouse's telephone number at work? Was your spouse with you? Does your spouse have any children? If so, how many? Where do they live? What are your parents' names? Where do they live? Where do they live? If so, how many? What are their names? Was your spouse with you? If no, when and where was the last time your spouse saw them? Where do they live? Does your spouse have any brothers and sisters? If so, how many? What are their names? When and where was the first time you met? Were you present with your spouse? Where did you go? When did you go? How long was the trip? Draw a picture of the bedroom and put furniture in place. Who sleeps on which side of the bed? Who showers first in the morning? How many bedrooms in your apartment? What is in each drawer? Are you on any medication? If so, what kind? Is your spouse on any medication? If so, what kind? Who does the laundry? Who picks up mail? Who feeds the pets? Who gets home first each day? What is your favorite flower? What is your spouse's favorite flower? What was the last furniture you bought together? What perfume aftershave do you wear? What perfume aftershave does your spouse wear? What was the last movie you saw together? Who drives it most often? Is it male or female? If so, what is the address? If so, what is the address? Do you have a joint bank account? How much is in the account? If so, what is the bank? How much is in the account? Does your spouse have a separate bank account?
So the kiss is an affiliate form of Hockett, of duetted turn-taking and silent polyphony. In 2015, Emma, made a voiceover installation that was performed live in a show of Carolee Schneemann's Infinity Kisses series, which is an ongoing series of both photographs and film of her cats kissing her in the mornings. I quote Brandon LaBelle, author of Lexicon of the Mouth. In bringing two mouths together, the kiss creates its own dwelling, a privacy that always already exceeds itself. Mouth Body, which was performed in a darkened gallery space called the Merchant House in Amsterdam, was an attempt to inhabit the architecture of the kiss. And I'll just read a brief excerpt. That two tongues fold into one, always a fold within the fold, like a cavern within the cavern. That the labyrinth of continuity is not a line which would dissolve into independent points, like sand flowing into grains, but is like a piece of fabric or a sheet of paper which divides into an infinite number of folds or disintegrates into curved movements. A mouth thing. That what withdraws from us draws us along by its very withdrawal. That once we are drawn into the withdrawal, we are drawing towards what draws. That as we are drawing toward what withdraws, we ourselves are pointers pointing toward.
Relays bring in the team concept. There are two types of baton exchanges used in the sprint relays. A blind exchange is used in the 4x100 and 4x200 relays. An open or visual exchange is used in the 4x400. The blind exchange. In this exchange, the outgoing runner never sees the baton. The incoming runner calls for the outgoing runner's hand. The outgoing runner puts his arm back with the hand palm up and the thumb out. The incoming runner places the baton in the extended hand. The exchange zone for the 4x100 and 4x200 is 20 meters long with a 10-meter acceleration zone. The outgoing runner may start at the beginning of the acceleration zone, but the baton must be passed within the 20-meter exchange zone. Personnel. In the 4x100 relay, two of the runners must run on the curve and two on the straightaway. In order to take advantage of the curve, the first and third runners should run in the inside of their lane. The second and fourth runners will be on the outside of their lane. The baton should start in the first runner's right hand. Then it goes left, right, left. Do not change hands. Visualize a baton moving around the track in the middle of the lane. The right-left concept will take advantage of the curves and also keep the runners from colliding on the exchanges. With all this in mind, here's how to select your relay team. The leadoff runner needs to be a good starter. The last thing you want is a false start. On the starting line, place the thumb and forefinger on the ground and hold the baton in the last three fingers. The second and third runners must be good at handling the baton, as they must both receive and hand off. The first and third runners need to be strong curve runners. Your fourth leg is usually the fastest and most competitive. If you do have a weak leg, use your best runner in the second or third position in order to break open the race and put the pressure on the other teams.
Here's one of the drills we do called the stick, stick, stick drill for the 4x1 relay. This drill gives each athlete an opportunity to pass the baton. Make sure that they see the target before they pass the baton in the other man's hand. The responsibility for the person that's carrying the baton is to put the stick in the man's hand. The responsibility for the outgoing man is to take the baton. This is called stick, stick, stick drill, and you'll see them pass it as they go. Okay, fellas.
Stick. Stick.
Go back again. Make it faster. Good. See the hand. Go back again. Make sure you see the hand.
Stick. Stick. Stick.
One of the most natural ways to pass the baton is turning the baton slightly as though you were getting ready to punch somebody in the back. He pulls his hand back. You lay the baton down crossways, not straight up. There's a bone on his hand. If you hit it, you hear a pop. And a lot of times, a lot of athletes lose the baton that way because the hand doesn't close naturally. If you lay it down in the palm, crossways, that fingers will wrap around. He has the ability to pull it away and the baton and the exchange is completed. Each athlete you see in the back, they're setting up their marks. They're walking off step by step. That allows them to have a smooth pass from this line, this arrow here, and there's another arrow up 20 meters. The ideal place to complete the pass is in the middle of the zone. They will give each one about anywhere from 24 to 25 steps of their own steps. They will lay the tape down. This is the mark in which the incoming runner hits, which allows him to move.
So now, for our last exercise, before we are joined by Ona Lindquist on the hour, we're going to do which one should we do first here? We wanted to do two things before. One is talk with Aaron a little bit about engine aspiration, and also to do a breathing exercise sort of entwined with that in a way. Mm. So maybe just quickly as a way of describing something that you can do with somebody else. Although at the end of our episode today, we will be doing a designing another exercise in the studio with Ona Lindquist, our guest. I still want to do this one quick, or try to do it. So in thinking about relays or relay races, interlocking in different ways.
And taking advantage of the curve.
And yes, as
Emma running.
Taking advantage of the curve. I want to get the three of us to, I guess we're going to have to sort of lean in on this. But essentially what we're going to do is try to coordinate our breathing. But just coordinate the amount, the moment at which our out-breath is completely exhausted itself. So what's happening on a relay race, as was described in that video, the first part that you could hear, is that for, you know, maximum efficiency, the runner, the first runner, let's say, who's going to pass the baton, has to, at the time of passing, be in a moment of total fatigue, total exhaustion. They've exerted everything. But at the same time, the runner that's picking up the baton has to be in a moment of total acceleration, right? Just reaching their fastest point. And that weird kind of snap overlap, I think, is sort of interesting. This place of fatigue, and at the other time, this place of like fullness.
Acceleration.
Yeah. So kind of matching that to breath, what we're going to do is we're going to coordinate our out breaths. And to make this audible connected to you, we'll be breathing a little bit into our microphones, but also what I want each of us to do is extend our, if we can reach each other, extend our right arm out to the person on our right, and extend it so that your palm is facing in a very sensing way right in front of their mouth where they might breathe, and see if you can already space yourself in a way. Oh, we lost a microphone. Space yourself in a way. Ready? Try to hover your hand just until you start to feel the kind of coolness of their breath out of their nose, just so you know you're close enough. And maybe vice versa, you start to smell the kind of sweaty clamminess of that hand. It's maybe trying to warm itself in the cold. So once you're in position, what we're going to do, let's say I start, by coordinating out-breaths and reaching that maximum amount of fatigue, what I mean is that by the time that I've totally vacated my lung, totally, completely vacated my lung, and Emma, who is to my left and is feeling my breath, feels that, stops feeling breath, she starts to out-breathe, she starts to exhale. So she has to also time her inhale in order to do that and hold her inhale. So let's try this. Everybody with their hands out. I'll start, then Emma's going to go, and then Aaron's going to go, and it'll come back to me. So remember, you're waiting for the coldness of that breath to stop, at which point you start unbreathing. Or exhaling.
So one of us is holding our breath for a while.
or you can breathe in when I've breathed out.
Okay.
Thank you. really trying to time it just at that last moment where there's a little tickle push out of that last bit of breath. Speeding up so it becomes one big exhale. Great.
Thank you.
Lightheaded.
Yeah. Yeah, so I've been dealing with engine maintenance recently, and just on the topic of Hockett's, I mean, engine is something that's also very finely timed, and the byproduct of which is often referred to as a voice. I mean, an exhaust is spoken about with almost exclusively vocal terms. Like, it can bark, it can whisper, it can hum, it can drone. And like a Hockett, it sort of this final voice is very much determined by the timing of all these parts. And when things aren't timed correctly, of course, the engine doesn't run well. And a good mechanic, I've learned, can listen to the voice of the exhaust and how it sounds, and diagnose what's going on inside the engine timing-wise, sort of like watching a chaotic crowd or group of people interacting and figuring out what's going wrong with the, group psychology. But this is a video that we found that, where this guy is talking about motorcycle engines and the sounds they make and how people react to them.
I'm Kevin Cameron, indoors on a beautiful day in my little shop. And I want to talk about something that is important to a lot of motorcyclists, and that is engine sound. Because motorcycles have every different number of cylinders that you can imagine, up to generally 6 as a maximum, singles, twins, triples, fours, at least a couple of 6s. BMW makes one, Honda makes one, the Goldwing 1500. Single cylinder engine, generally speaking, an uninteresting sound, because it sounds like a lawnmower. When you make a twin, the British twins fired at 360 degrees, which meant that they had an even 360 degree firing order. Every revolution they fired, and they made a kind of droning sound. Lovers of British twins like that sound. Possibly a more interesting sound is made when you move those cylinders apart to make a V-twin. Now you have a difference in the firing order, so that there is a quiet time, then a cylinder fires, then a shorter quiet time, and another cylinder fires, giving a kind of syncopated da-dit, da-dit, which is why V-twins have a sort of more like a V8 sound and is a more interesting sound to listen to. Clearly, the closer the V angle comes to zero, the more it sounds like a British twin. And out at 90 degrees, there's Ducati, who've chosen that 90 degree angle because it allows their engine to be self-balancing for primary shaking force. But then we get to the triple. Triples usually have their crank pins at 120 degrees, and they produce a wonderful musical sound, which I have enjoyed since the first time I heard the Kawasaki H1 in 1969. Then we get to the very popular four-cylinder bikes. Most of them have a so-called flat crankshaft with its crank pins at 180 degrees so that the cylinders in the middle, the number two and number three cylinder at top dead center, when number one and number four are at bottom dead center. As a result, the engine fires twice per revolution and the firing interval is always the same. So on a high revving engine, a flat crank four produces the famous GSXR screech. Yamaha, after their experience with the M1 road race bike, which was converted to 90 degree crank pins for the 2004 season, rider Valentino Rossi, who was hired by Yamaha newly that year, liked the 90 degree crank pin angle better than he liked the 180, so that's what he got. But in terms of sound, like a V-twin differs from a parallel twin, a 90 degree crank pin inline four cylinder makes a throatier, more V8-like sound and does not produce GSXR screech. So that's an interesting difference. And then you have BMW's Touring 6, which is one of the smoothest engines that there is. And it also produces a very smooth sound, just like that of a Jaguar inline six or a Merlin V12 of World War II. They all have a very similar, quite civilized purr. And then there's the Honda Goldwing, which is a flat six. It has three cylinders this way and three cylinders this way. The aim of this is that you have enough cylinders that they can cancel each other's shaking force, leaving the engine smooth enough for touring. Engine sound also has a component that is...